Today, our topic is going to be talking a little bit about the 1980s. Actually, it's going to be talking a lot about the 1980s and about some of the historical and political similarities that we're seeing between President Ronald Reagan and today's president, Donald Trump, as well as movies and pop culture, music, the type of trends that identified that era and how they're slowly eking their way back into society at large. I would say within the last almost decade, but certainly within the last couple of years, we're going to be discussing this with Dr. Martin Quirk, professor of history at Rock Valley College in Rockford, Illinois. Dr. Quirk, how are you doing?
I am doing well, Sean. Thank you for having me on again.
Thank you. I'd like to start by talking about a retrospective look of politics during the 1980s. We can see that there are a lot of similarities, actually, between President Ronald Reagan and today's president, Donald Trump. They're both celebrity presidents in their own right, but they also share other similarities. They're also each the oldest elected presidents in their time. They each also have specific agendas related to domestic policies like taxes, and specifically involving larger tax cuts for the wealthier people with a lower tax mentality. And of course, the idea that by detaxing and getting rid of some regulation, deregulating some of this, that will initially and hopefully for the long term boost the economy, as well as also employing sort of a military Keynesianism for support of boosting military budgets, again, also in order to boost the economy. Does that all sound like things that sort of typify Reagan, but also could apply to Donald Trump today?
Absolutely. And you need to remember that Donald Trump made a huge amount of money in the Reagan era. He was typical of trickle-down economics. He benefited from Reagan policies, first President Bush policies, the real estate bubble, all of those things. So I don't think it's surprising that President Trump would be similar to Reagan. I would add, too, and Republicans tend to forget this because Ronald Reagan is such an icon of the Republican Party, that Reagan began life as an outsider, too. When Reagan began to campaign for the presidency, he was too old. He was too far right for many Republicans. They did not necessarily see him winning the presidency. He seemingly hung on, much like Donald Trump did during the primaries, and then became president. And I think the other thing that is incumbent upon both of them, and you hinted at it with the discussion of the rebuilding of the military, is this nationalism, this national pride that was really invigorated by Ronald Reagan. We've seen less of it with President Trump so far. With him, it's more just straight up nationalism, which would be a marked difference between the two, I think, in a major way. But I think there are enough similarities, and especially economically, because Donald Trump benefited from Reagan-era economic policies.
Yeah, I have this theory called the touch of the president, where essentially every president who has ever has had some type of influence from a different president, and it doesn't even have to be the president immediately preceding them, but they have to have some interaction with some president in order to become president. And I thought about Donald Trump actually before this interview and had researched some, and there's not a whole lot of 1980s research you can do without running into Donald Trump. It's just inevitable.
Yeah.
But I found a picture, sure enough, of Donald Trump shaking hands with Ronald Reagan. And it made me consider the idea, and I think maybe people who are listening will get this too, that it reminds me a little bit of Back to the Future, in the sense that when you're looking at that movie, there's two time settings. There's the 1950s and the 1980s. And I think when you look at Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump, you know, Ronald Reagan is very emblematic of the 1980s, but he's got a 1950s sort of culture and persona and mentality. And I feel like the same could be said of Donald Trump, not necessarily from the 1950s, but rather from the 1980s. The 1950s was the heyday for Ronald Reagan, but he exists almost permanently in the 1980s as sort of a callback to that era. And I feel like the same could be said for Donald Trump today as a callback to the 1980s. Would you say that's sort of a fair assessment of how they represent themselves and their personalities and their brand?
I understand the argument, but when you begin to look at especially the area of foreign policy, Reagan embarked upon a very activist foreign policy. Just to use an example, after the end of the Vietnam War in 1973 and 1975, the United States pulled back from global military operations. Within a year of becoming president, Reagan had launched one of the largest deployments of troops overseas to Lebanon for a multinational peacekeeping force. 1983, he invades the island of Grenada.
Right.
He launches airstrikes on Libya. We have a robust naval presence that triggers conflicts with the Soviets at sea, with the Libyans. If he responds to terrorism by direct bombings. And if you look at President Trump, he very much thinks of America first and seemingly is disengaging more from the world at a time where President Reagan confronted Russia in a major way with SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative. President Reagan also sent Pershing missiles to Germany, which really shook up the Soviet Union in a major way and ultimately led to the end of the Cold War. So if President Trump was really rooted in the 1980s, I think we would see more of this move towards globalism and greater American responsibility in the world. Instead, he's going back. He's almost, if you want to think about it a little bit, he's almost more in the mold of, say, 1920s presidents.
Sure, that sense of isolationism.
Yes, and some of the social things, especially issues of white supremacy and Americanism and immigration restrictions that have come up. You know, Ronald Reagan, Republicans acknowledge this, you know, when the illegal immigrant amnesty argument's made, Reagan created the last really big amnesty where people were able to get legal status.
Yes, and I do think that contrast is important. Reagan is always hailed as a Republican hero, but that amnesty agreement would seem to be at odds with the Republican Party of today. We also see that Reagan's administration is marked by some terrific highs, like the Iran hostage situation and its resolvement, and devastating lows, like Lebanon. Yet both presidents share this enormous groundswell of populist support throughout their campaigns and into their administrations.
I certainly think the populism is there. I mean, Reagan was a very populist president in some ways. You know, what's also interesting is that this desire to cut regulations, which is less heralded concerning the Trump administration, is very Reagan-esque. Reagan cut regulations. You know, I was just thinking about this the other day. There was an announcement about President Trump's initiative about food stamps to give people food rather than money. And, you know, anybody who grew up in the 1980s remembers the phrase government cheese, where Ronald Reagan discovers that there's these huge troves of surplus cheese bought up in the name of price supports, and he gave it away to people, to recipients of various food aid programs. And so, you know, that was the first thing I thought of when I heard, oh, we're going to give people bags of food. It's like, okay, are they going to get free cheese too? And, you know, it just, you know, Reagan's kind of disdain for government, Ronald Reagan's favorite quote, government's not the solution, it's the problem. And with all the executive orders we've seen from President Trump, he he sort of shares that view. You know, whether it's cutting environmental regulations, Ronald Reagan and President Bush, who followed him, were both great critics of PBS and the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts. And President Trump, it's been lost in a very busy first year, but President Trump was thinking of doing away with PBS. So there are some doctrinaire elements in there, definitely, that they share.
And I think also, despite some really positive benefits in the 1980s, shifting a little bit to take a look at things like affirmative action, there were also other parts of the 1980s that were not so great, specifically in the public as they endeavored to fight the AIDS and crack epidemics. And we see that currently neither of those things is Ronald Reagan's fault. And in comparing this to the opioid crisis that we seem to be dealing with today, that is not inherently Donald Trump's fault either. But I do think it's an interesting contrast between those two administrations, how those negative impacts on a lot of, you know, people at the ground level really is seen as a stain on Reagan's administration, as it could potentially be on Donald Trump's if it's not addressed in the correct way. And I know that Donald Trump has also talked about it at length and said that, you know, healthcare, in addition to taxes, healthcare is also a mess. And of course, the Republican Party in 2017, 2018, that's been a long, hard-fought battle for them, is to try and push healthcare reform. And I know that's one of the bigger issues, I think, with this administration as well.
Well, I think you're onto something in that both Ronald Reagan, you know, they're very different times socially, so that's got to be factored in there. But I think both Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump very much have this nostalgic 1950s image of America. And to them, a lot of the problems America has is because of changes that happen in America, and there are social changes too. Ronald Reagan certainly has been criticized for his response to the AIDS epidemic, and Donald Trump has certainly been criticized for his response to the opioid epidemic and the nature of healthcare. So I think there is a comparison to be made there, but also I think both of them view America through this simpler prism, social ideals, and America is messier than that. It's interesting that one of the first big issues President Trump decided to deal with was transgendered military troops. Things were moving forward. There were troops who were transitioning, who were serving openly on active duty, and then in one tweet, everything was changed.
Yeah.
Or at least put into a state of upset. So I think that's another big issue, too. So I would agree they both probably have a little more nostalgic image, but they're playing to a base that wanted that, a base who wants America to be great again. You know, Ronald Reagan, when he ran for reelection, you know, it's morning in America. You know, all these things are happening, you know, and things have been turned around and made better. And I think that's what Donald Trump ran on. Donald Trump, you know, ran on this very dark image of America. Ronald Reagan probably inherited a little more dark America in the sense that, you know, it was the Iranian hostage crisis, the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. America was still living under this malaise, the shadow of Vietnam. So I think Reagan was really living it, and Donald Trump was largely elected in many ways on this idea that he was showing America that there are these problems and we're going to fix them. So I think they're similar in that way. I think both of them had this similar let's make America great again ideal.
And I think also once Reagan leaves office, every Republican tries to inherit the mantle of Reagan, if you will. And Donald Trump has said that several times, you know, I'm the best president, or I'm the best Republican president since Reagan. I don't doubt that he's also said I'm the best president since Reagan, but I don't want to put words in his mouth that he's probably said before I check his Twitter. So, but that is something, yeah, I can definitely see that. And I wonder, because you touched on this a little bit in your answer, you know, the 1970s was a very tumultuous time for America, and specifically, of course, with Watergate and Nixon in general. Do you think that people are reverting to the nostalgia of the 80s, both culturally and historically today? Do you think that they pine for it because the 70s was so tumultuous and they sort of want to forget the Nixon administration? Of course, Jimmy Carter as well, and the hostage crisis, which was immediately preceding Reagan.
Well, I think that's true. I'm not sure people today are really ignoring the 1970s. If you look at recent fashion trends and nostalgia in TV shows and resurgence of shows or movies like Star Wars and the remaking of movies, I don't think they're skipping over the 1970s necessarily. I think there's a lot of nostalgia for the 1980s fueled by politics, because we did have a good economy in the 1980s, especially compared to the 70s. Although there was also a lot of economic trouble. There was a huge farm crisis in the 1980s. Many manufacturing cities like those in Illinois continued to see job losses. Manufacturing changed in a big way. Jobs continued to leave. So that was a big issue. It's interesting that Donald Trump, in many ways, the economic picture he paints and some of the things he says about reinvigorating manufacturing probably belong in the 1980s. Sounds a little more like that because, you know, today's manufacturing scene and the loss of manufacturing jobs is, you know, some of it's due to foreign competition, but many scholars believe that the greater change in manufacturing is automation and the replacing of human workers with automated workers. So I think he talks about the job losses, but he talks about them really in a 1980s way. So I think there's this political nostalgia for that. But yeah, I don't think it's necessarily we skipped over the 70s, except for the fact we need to freely acknowledge that the three presidents of the 1970s are probably not three of our better presidents. If we look at it, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Jimmy Carter, that's not exactly the dream team right there. So if you go to the 1980s, you have the two terms of Ronald Reagan, the victory in the Cold War. You have the first President Bush right at the end taking office in 1989. So, yeah, especially if you're a Republican, looking back at the 1980s is probably the place you want to be in many ways.
I guess I mean to say that they want to forget, although I think you might want to forget those presidents. You know, there seems to be a real focus on going back to the 80s and a real desire to, you know, harken back to the time where kids rode bikes outside and, you know, they played D&D in their basements and people didn't have cell phones and they just went out until whenever and they came back. And, you know, you think about, especially, I would say, you think about John Hughes films, you know, most of the adults are befuddled, out of date, out of touch individuals who don't understand their complex teenage counterparts. And I think we see more of that same kind of tone, albeit with some slight twists to it, a la Stephen King and Steven Spielberg in shows like Stranger Things, where the parents are a little more wise to certain things going on. But the 70s is an era that people generally think of as pretty important, but they don't necessarily want to go back to it. And as you said, the 1980s is a time of prosperity. Why wouldn't you want to go back to the good times, you know?
And it's the beginning of much of the technology we have today. You know, the beginning of personal computing and those kind of developments that would become much bigger. And I think also we can't forget that many of the people who are producing TV shows and creating them are people who grew up in the 1980s. And so those are nostalgic times for them. And for this generation, it seems simpler in the 1980s. The 1980s seems simpler. It was an era before helicopter parents. It was the era of latchkey kids. And, you know, I have three children myself, and you watch Stranger Things and you think, well, I'd never let my kids do that. What are those kids doing riding bikes without bicycle helmets?
Right.
What are they doing out at night? You know, where are their parents?
I love that the first concern you had was, where are their bike helmets? That's a parent right there.
Yes. If you think about it, you know, you look at modern parents, it's like, they're not wearing bike helmets. You know, and I think, you know, it was an age when people rode in pickup trucks. And Blake Shelton has, the country singer, has a new song that said, I lived it. And one of the lines in the song is riding around in the back of the pickup truck with his grandfather. Well, his grandfather smoked cigarettes with the windows rolled up. You know, nowadays, you know, if my children's grandfather, you know, came over and sat in the house smoking a cigarette, we'd all lose that. We would all. So I think there is a certain, you know, sentimentality to it. But also compared today, it is a simpler time. And people remember that childhood, I think, in that nostalgic way, in a very big deal. So,
and I did read some articles that mentioned that, especially in the case of 80s music, although I think it has never left, but I'm also musically very inclined towards the 80s, a lot of the music from the 1980s was sort of the soundtrack to a lot of 2000s and 90s kids, because that's their parents' music. You know, they were a young person, so to speak, about in their 20s or early 30s, and that's what they were listening to. And so that's how some of the culture has been transplanted on, is through these childhood memories of listening to, you know, take your pick, whether it's Michael Jackson, Hall & Oates, Madonna, any of some of those big 1980s musicians.
Well, if you look at music, it's also interesting. If you couple that with TV reruns, one of the interesting things about 1980s TV shows and music is they become really integrated. TV shows used to have themes just like they do today, but until the middle 80s, this idea of actually playing real pop songs in TV shows did not fully take hold. And it was the quintessential 1980s TV show which launched this, and that is, of course, Miami Vice. Miami Vice, from its pilot episode with Phil Collins in the air tonight, launches, you know, this idea of every episode kind of having a theme song fitting, you know, what's going on in the episode. And then with the rise of music videos, Miami Vice had a soundtrack which featured all these songs. You know, one episode that's memorable because it had Ted Nugent in it, although Ted Nugent did not sing, featured the classic 1980s song by Godley and Cream, Cry, which you're probably too young to have ever heard. And then there's another episode with the Dire Straits song, Brothers in Arms, which, you know, there's this very emotional final scene, and the song is playing throughout the last, you know, 7-8 minutes of the episode. And once Miami Vice started to do it, most TV shows had songs, you know, had their own soundtracks that went with them, and, you know, still do it today. And so there's that integration of music. So a lot of people associate these songs with TV shows they saw over and over again, and just this integration of music. And a lot of 1980s music, I think, today appeals to people in several ways. You know, the musicality of it, the advancements that took place there. And it was a very active time musically in a lot of ways in terms of new genres and trends. So I think it comes about in big ways.
Sure. Yeah, I think we also see a lot of different dialogues and cultural experiences being presented for the first time during the 1980s. This is hugely significant to audiences, either as women or minorities who identified with these characters, or as a way to introduce these conceptually different shows to a predominantly mainstream white audience. Hill Street Blues was the new model for a police procedural show, which utilized a more realistic shaky cam style of shooting, in addition to involving more of the personal dilemmas the characters face and internalize outside the police station. From here, we also see the same formula adapted for a medical drama, St. Elsewhere, which illuminates the personal lives of doctors, again, outside of the operating room. And just as we experienced with Miami Vice as a buddy cop show, we're later introduced to Cagney and Lacey, right? The first two women cops. So it's a buddy cop show, but they're ladies. That's the twist. And, you know, that dialogue speaking to women and also showing that they can be strong characters in and of themselves. Shows begin to create these fully realized three-dimensional characters who drive the plot and in most cases are the central focus of the show. But the diversity shown in these castings, especially in the cases of shows like The Cosby Show, showcasing a positive representation of a highly educated upper-middle-class African-American family, 30-something, which represented young adults who were already outside of the youth explosion and struggling to build careers and start families in their mid to late 20s/early 30s, who were not doctors or lawyers. They were just ordinary people. And lest we forget, the Golden Girls, which represented the viewpoint of older women and the difficulties that these women face in maturity. And without these networks diversifying the types of stories show creators could tell, I think today's programming would not exist as we know it.
I think you're right in many ways, because TV became more diversified coming out of the 1970s into the 1980s, and even just the ideas of the subjects of shows, I think, were more diverse. So, yes, I would definitely agree with that.
But in films, I feel like, you know, in the 1980s, they were original. There was an original concept, and they wrote it, and they produced it, and that's what it was. And I feel like today, several of the films that we're talking about and people enjoy are actually not even just that they are derivative of their 1980s concepts, but they're entirely rebooted as a lesser version, in some cases, of these 1980s film franchises. And I have a list here of all the films from 2010, which I feel really starts our trend back towards the 80s here. And on this list, it looks like we have 14 titles in 2010 that are either derivative or extremely leaning towards a 1980s intellectual property. In 2017, there is a total of 21 films and TV shows. And I didn't even count all the TV shows. So really, that's just Stranger Things, the second season of Stranger Things that's on that list. But, you know, there's a marked increase in the films and film franchises, I think, that we see from the 1980s, and they're making a huge resurgence today. And I think that has a lot to do with creators as well. And, you know, we see things like Blade Runner 2049 and, you know, an all-female reboot of Ghostbusters. Again, trying to address different dialogues. As a all-female Ghostbusters, it took a very feminist bent to the Ghostbusters in a way that was a dialogue for women, you know? The fact that they're women should be, I don't know that necessarily is in that film, but should be incidental to the fact that they are Ghostbusters. Because we're seeing properties like this, and also Mad Max and Transformers, these films with fantasy and dystopic themes that are being touched on again today, what do you think this says about society? That we're seeing this resurgence, and also that they're expressing these dialogues, as well as also showing these themes of fantasy and dystopias in array?
I think part of it is just pure nostalgia. It's comforting to go back to the past and bring forward the things you remember and you like, and especially in a time where we have to ponder, if you look deeply at history or the present, it begs analysis. So it's much easier to be like, oh, okay, I love Blade Runner. We're going to go back and look at and have Blade Runner again, but we're not really going to go too in-depth into the themes of what Blade Runner was about or what it means or what it might mean today. We're simply going to go back and enjoy the movie. And I think that's the heart of nostalgia compared to true historical examination, is you just want to remember it. Oh, this was good. Let's go back. And I think that's explainable by the discord and the upset and that's going on in America. Of course, you know, you want to go and look at these idealized versions, or you want to create an alternative reality.
And that that actually goes right into my next question here, because we see throughout the 1980s, again, subtly in comparison to the 1970s. The 1970s, the top films of that era are all, you know, the main characters are adults. And the conflicts, the root conflicts in these films are very adult themes. You know, something like The Godfather. The children are incidental to the plot, and they are rarely touched upon, if ever. It's all about adults and about lineage and legacy, and make sure you off this guy because he's a traitor to the family or whatever. And with the 1980s, we see this huge shift. Probably, I would say Back to the Future would be a completely different film without Michael J. Fox, who, of course, exemplified the young yuppie Republican in Family Ties, which is also a seminal classic of the 1980s in terms of TV. And we see kid protagonists throughout the 1980s, whether it's Back to the Future, The Karate Kid, but certainly kids rule at the box office when it comes to these 1980s films. And they're always
E.T.
And, yes.
The great, you know, E.T.'s a classic
Goonies.
Example. Grown-ups are going to ruin it. Kids sweep in, save it, you know, all of those ideas. And I think that's the idea of this nostalgia for the past in your own childhood. And, you know, grown-ups mess things up. Children can deal with them properly.
Right.
Or with a greater degree of innocence.
And so I guess I was thinking on all of those films and the level of permeation we've seen with the Disney company in terms of buying up these older franchises, whether it's Star Wars or even the much larger MCU, Marvel Cinematic Universe, with Marvel movies right now. Do you feel, as per your comment on creating alternate universes, do you feel that there's a level of cognitive dissonance in addition to the nostalgia that's occurring right now with the level of like Marvel and superhero films today compared with some of these top grossing fantasy films, and specifically films that are centered on kid protagonists in the 1980s?
I'm not sure. I think they both play to similar themes, even though the protagonists are different. They're big kids' movies. They're big childhood movies. So I'm just not sure. That would be my highly qualitative answer to that.
And, you know, it's just something that I feel in my bones, that in terms of the 1980s to now, we're sort of reverting back. Adults, I feel, are sort of reverting back to a little bit of, like, our youth and our kids' attitudes. And I am only 26, so I can't fully embrace this, because to embrace it would mean that I'm especially old. And I know that that is not the case. And also, I am frequently referred to as a kid when dealing with people who are 40 or 50 or even older. Any baby boomer is certainly still going to call me a kid, regardless of how old I actually am. And just to get an idea of the top grossing films of the 1980s, E.T., as you said, Return of the Jedi, The Empire Strikes Back, Batman, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Ghostbusters, Beverly Hills Cop seems to be the only, again, the only adult movie. The adults in situations, but also there's a fair amount of comedy in that. And Eddie Murphy is certainly, you know, one of the great comedians of the 80s. So that is understandable. Back to the Future and Indiana Jones 2 and 3, The Temple of Doom and The Last Crusade, also in that list. And we see the influences of Stephen King and Steven Spielberg even today throughout films. I know Ready Player One is about to come out in the next couple of months. We've seen The Dark Tower and a remake of It, as well as, but we've also seen a lot of these influences in Stranger Things, whose biggest audience is young people around my age, if not younger, looking at the millennial generation, who seem to be, as we had talked about a little bit before, hearkening back to the simpler age or pining for a time that they didn't live in. Do you think this is a normal phenomenon, that they desire to be in a point in time in which they did not experience firsthand and they have no knowledge of outside of the media that they've consumed?
Absolutely. And as a child of the 70s, the nostalgia for the 1950s and the early 60s, happy days, the resurgence of 1950s, 60s music, oldie shows on the radio, absolutely. So if you look at this generation, of course, you're going to look back at the 1980s, because to them, that's the time period when things were simpler. So it's just like when I was a kid, you know, people used to, you know, look at the 1950s and see it as a simpler time. And it allows them to kind of skip over, you know, more difficult times in some ways, too.
Absolutely.
Although it is interesting, I'm going to point this out, that if you watch much BBC broadcasting, they are locked in right now into the late 60s and early 70s. And that is interesting to me as a time period goes. In fact, if you want to see a show that kind of intersperses the two, there's a show called Life on Mars. It's about a cop in the 2000s in London who ends up being zapped back into the 1970s. No cell phones or anything. And it's very interesting that you go back to that nostalgia period. Or the BBC show Tennyson, which is a prequel to a Helen Mirren show from the 1990s. And it's the lead character as a young woman, and being a cop in early 1970s London is much very different. There was one episode that spoke hugely where she was expected to cover for a fellow detective who beat a confession out of someone, which was much more common in the 1970s. And it's interesting, we're looking back at this period in a time when there is so much attention on police brutality. So I think wherever you are, obviously the British have this pining for the 70s, and right now for the United States, it's the 1980s. And there's this idea, oh, you know, the music's good, and it was simpler, just like people in the 70s wanted the 50s.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm taking a look at some of the films expected out. Of course, any horror aficionados are going to know that Laurie Strode, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, is going to be returning to the Halloween franchise for the 10th film in the series, which will, I think, retcon several of the events of some of the previous movies and, of course, Rob Zombie's reimagining in the late 2000s, as well as Bruce Willis, who I think is headlining right now the new version of Death Wish, which was, of course, originally portrayed by Charles Bronson. You may also know him from The Great Escape. He plays Danny, and he's very claustrophobic.
Death Wish. And if you compare, in fact, I was doing some research on this the other day. When I saw the new Death Wish was coming out, they're completely different. Bronson's character was hugely wounded, and it was this huge commentary on the failure of society to deal with this huge burgeoning crime problem. And at the end of Death Wish, he is let go by the police. Charles Bronson is basically let go, allowed to just leave the city. And there's this poignant scene where the cop announces that they haven't caught the vigilante because crime rates were falling. So basically they decided they weren't going to solve this case of the vigilante because it was having a positive effect on the city, which is a complete 1970s commentary on the failure of system in America. It'd be very interesting to see Bruce Willis gets away with it. And the new one, although it does not seem as dark as the original.
Yes, and as I had previously mentioned, a lot of these seem to be very derivative of their original source material. So I doubt very strongly that any, and I'll go see it today, honestly, but I will doubt that it's going to be anywhere even close to the original power and intensity of the Charles Bronson Death Wish series. So a lot of really interesting remakes happening now that, again, are extremely derivative of their initial 1980s counterparts. Are there any lasting impressions you have about the 1980s in contrast to today, Dr. Quirk? Anything that you think we didn't touch on and people ought to be aware of coming in the future? Maybe something to look out for if it makes a resurgence?
Well, you know, history never really fully repeats itself, but I think it's interesting to see what would be nice to make a resurgence, and this has been commented on by older members of Congress, is it would be nice to see a bit of return of bipartisanship. And I don't think we have seen that yet. There were some very big bipartisan bills that were passed in the 1980s. So maybe we have that to look forward to.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice thought. I certainly hope that there's some bipartisanship, but I also don't know if that'll happen in this administration. Because, like President Reagan, seems to be a lot of gridlock and opposition to this non-celebrity president, which is something that Reagan himself faced in his early years. Even coming off of that substantial win politically as far as the Iran hostage crisis ending very early on in his first administration, I myself have some theories about what may happen in the next 2 years. I'm not a political analyst, but I would think that maybe a Kennedy could run for president in the next couple of years here.
And then we'll all be talking about the return of Camelot.
Yes, in the 1960s. You know what? I'm good. I saw Mad Men. I can watch that again at any point, so I'm okay. My thanks again to Dr. Quirk, history professor from Rock Valley College in Rockford, Illinois. Are there any projects or any reviews that you're working on that people can look out for in the coming future here?
Not anything yet, but I am doing a couple of different projects rooted in the 1970s. So I myself am more caught up in the nostalgia of the 70s right now. So
good luck to you with that. And thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you, Sean.